This is Outline After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 453 for February 22 of 2019, How to Engineer an Electric Hot Rod. Watch Outline After Hours live at Outline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
All right, Gary, we get to do another show.
Indeed. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. You just came in on the red eye?
Yeah.
Man.
You're a brave soul.
It's dedication. Got to be on the show.
Yeah. Back from San Diego?
Yeah. And I got to drive in the snow yesterday.
Yeah, I did the same thing. I'm back on the red eye from Las Vegas.
Yeah.
But you recover well. I mean, I'm wiped out the day after a red eye.
This, by the way, is Henry Payne, our friend from the Detroit News.
Our critic from the Detroit News.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you guys are nice to have me.
Yeah. Well, the reason that we wanted you on is you're the owner of a Tesla Model 3. Mm-hmm. And our special guest today is Dave Fulton. He's an EV powertrain expert at BorgWarner. And great to have you on the show, Dave.
Thank you. Appreciate the invite.
You know, I've been telling our viewers all week long, you know, about you coming on the show, and I've been sort of pitching it this way that, hey, you know how to polish the ports, you know how to mill the head, you know how to bolt on a blower, but do you know anything about EV powertrains? I know nothing. So let's start at the very, very basics. There's AC electricity and there's DC electricity. Now, I know DC is direct current, you know, it just flows in one direction. Mm-hmm. AC sort of goes back and forth, kind of, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do you make AC? How do you make DC? How do you make these differently?
Well, batteries lend themselves to making DC current just because of the...
Well, they store it. They don't make it, right?
Right, right. When you
have a path for them
to a flow available for the current, the voltage that they produce, just a chemical reaction that creates an electrical potential between two points. It wants to drive electrons from one place to another. And when you attach the motor to it or any kind of wire circuit, you give them the opportunity to drive those electrons where they want to go by virtue of that chemical reaction. It doesn't want to reverse itself. It just doesn't work that way. The chemicals are where they are, and so the pressure to drive flow only goes one way. And when you want to take that and drive a machine that is AC, and of course that begs the question, well, why AC machines? Because there are DC machines,
right,
where you can just hook them up directly to a battery and they run with no other boxes in between. But the DC machines that we've known for years have brushes in them, the carbon brushes that tend to, that those wear out. They're not efficient, not near as efficient as and power dense as the AC machines. It just works out that way. And a long time ago, Nikola Tesla came up with this idea of if you have a alternating current that goes back and forth, and you can create a rotating magnetic field on the stationary part of the motor called the stator, and it goes around, and the rotor, which has its own magnetic field, wants to follow it. And it's somewhat similar to the people doing the wave around a stadium. You know, it's the AC.
Analogy.
Every person in the stadium is going up and down. That's AC in a sense. It goes one way and then it goes the other way. It's changing polarity. But the people in the stadium are displaced with respect to position and time. And what he goes up and down at the same time. So you're passing the high point of the wave from one person to the next in a different position. And that's the same kind of concept for a multi-phase motor with AC current. And so the rotor wants to follow that rotating wave. But if you looked at just one spot on the stator and you put some kind of a sensor there that sense polarity, magnetic polarity, it would just sit there and go north, south, north, south. But next to it's doing the same thing, just a little bit displaced in time and so forth. So this is the basic operating principle of how you generate motion and torque with an AC motor. But then, like, your original question is, how do you get from that energy storage that does DC so well to this AC machine that's a lot more power dense and efficient. And that is the other piece of electric drives, which is the inverter. And that basically for today's EVs, which are generally three-phase, what we call three-phase, three different circuits of three different currents displaced in time, those things are created by inverters which have six switches in them, not the mechanical switches, but six solid-state switches called power transistors. And those switches can turn on and off very quickly, thousands of times a second if we want them to, and they create kind of a digital sine wave, if you will. They create a voltage that looks like pulses of voltage that go positive and negative, and they create roughly sine wave currents inside the motor. So that's what the motor's, that's what you're striving for. You'll tolerate somewhat less than that. And so this inverter is key to the operation of the motor, and you want it to be as efficient as possible because you lose some power as in the form of heat when you make that conversion from DC to AC. And when you go the other way around, that motor can act as a generator when I'm trying to do regen braking and bring the vehicle to a stop, but save some of that power or that energy, basically, back into the energy storage. I have to go through that conversion process the other way. And there's actually a lot of work that goes into the software that tells those six switches when to turn on and off. There are a lot of trade-offs as far as how efficient that is, how noisy it is, because you actually can hear the inverter, the whine of the inverter, if it was not high enough in frequency to be above human hearing level, which should probably be in the 10 to 20,000 hertz, you know, cycles per second kind of range. And it also can give you more power. If you control it one way versus another, you can get 10 or 15% more power out of the electric motor with the same battery. It's kind of counterintuitive.
So for electric hot rodders, the inverter is one of the keys?
It is. It's probably the hardest to change. You'd probably need to change the whole inverter and you'd have to have a lot of inside knowledge to know what to do. It's a very
physically change the inverter? I mean, it would.
Yeah, the inverters that I've seen are typically not open to be able to go in and reprogram. Mm-hmm. There are inverters sold that are all kind of open source code where you can go in and make your changes, and those would be the ones if you were a hot rodder, you'd want to go after that. But I think the tier ones and OEMs are doing a really good job of eking out all you can get out of those. They may have made some trade-offs towards the end of high efficiency versus power output. And that might be one where somebody really wanted to get the most power might have made some different changes, you know.
Is the inverter like a valve that controls the ultimate performance of the motor, which you guys bizarrely call machines for some reason?
Yeah. I mean, normally most people, including myself, will fall back into calling it a motor. But because you can run that motor and run mechanical power through it to generate electricity without changing the mechanical parts that we're using. We kind of call it e-machine or electrical machine because it is really just a bi-directional power converter. You can go from electric to mechanical power or torque and speed, or I can go from kinetic energy of the vehicle going down the road and I can bring it to a stop by generating electrical power into the battery and create a torque that works against the motion of the car. So,
and that's the regen that we all feel.
Right.
Yeah, when we back off the brake, that's the regeneration
back
going
off
on through
the throttle.
That's all happening through the inverter.
Right. And the single pedal control that a lot of people talk about, you can turn up the rate at which you're trying to put that vehicle kinetic energy back into the battery. And of course, that will decelerate the car more. So if you really turn that up to its maximum possible rate of energy storage, that provides the most deceleration to the vehicle, and maybe you don't even need to touch the brake.
Yeah. So.
And that's a way to make it more efficient, right? Capture more of the energy.
Yeah.
One of the analogies that I sometimes use in talking to people about electric cars, I say it's like a blender, right? So you have your kitchen blender, and so it's not going, and then you hit 10, right? You don't go through the steps. You hit 10, and you get instant torque. So in a blender, that's a motor because it only goes one way.
Yeah.
But in Henry's Model 3, it's a machine because of the generation?
Yeah, if you choose to use it in as a motor and a generator, depending on the time and the operation of the vehicle, then you'd probably call it an e-machine. But for instance, a starter motor, for instance, only gets used as a motor. Now, if I wanted to, and I've done this before, you take a starter motor off, you hack off the front end, you put a drill on it, and I can light up a light bulb with a starter motor. But nobody's ever going to want to use it that way, so we call it a motor. But it really can be a generator if we wanted it to be. And that's really true of any electric machine. We just don't think of it because we think about the intent, the purpose of what we're trying to use it for. And when you get into EVs or even hybrid vehicles, those things that we used to just call motors or just call generators actually get, they have to do both functions. It just depends upon what the mode of the vehicle is in. If you're trying to come to a stop, you aren't trying to supply more power mechanically to the wheels. You're trying to go the other way, absorb power into the battery. So that's why, not to be obtuse or something, we call it electric machines. It's a very generic way to just say it's a bi-directional way to convert.
Well, there, we all learned. And I didn't know that you knew that, Gary. Now, Henry, you and I can be really cool to talk about electric machines. Show everybody we know.
Yeah, right.
Hey, another thing that's really interesting, and you showed me what you're doing at BorgWarner, is how you are designing an electric powertrain from the get-go. Mm-hmm. So you're not just taking an electric motor, you're not just taking a transmission, you're not just taking all the power electronics and putting them together. You're really designing it from the get-go to all go together. And you're right, coming up with some really tighter packages than before.
Right. We're really trying to get value engineering out of that. And so you're eliminating redundant things that you don't need. For instance, if you've got the motor and the inverter, which both need to be liquid-cooled, right next to each other, I can get rid of hoses that would connect them if they were in separate locations. Same thing with the three-phase cables, very large power cables.
The big orange cable.
Yeah, the big orange ones. With those, you have to do EMI shielding and things like that. They're very expensive. We can get rid of those if we co-locate those pieces right next to each other. So it's where they really want to be. And there are other reasons why you get rid of inductance and things like that that does, probably aren't at first glance obvious why that would be helpful. But you get rid of some of the things that you don't want when you do that. You add some stiffness to the whole box that you put together, because now those parts, like an inverter, for instance, if it was located off to the side, doesn't actually act like a frame that stiffens the whole structure of the motor.
It's not a stressed member.
Right.
Now it is a stressed member.
It is, because it's got an aluminum box around it and it has some stiffness. So that's an advantage. The other thing is you can match the motor and the inverter together if you're selling this as a product, an integrated drive module, which we call IDM for that reason.
We got a picture of it up here.
Oh, yeah, there you go. We can make sure that the inverter and the motor were supposed to be designed for maximum system efficiency. It turns out that's a big trade-off.
All right, so for those who are listening to this, they're not going to be able to understand what I'm saying, but on the left side, that's the motor, correct?
Right.
Which part is the inverter, the rest?
The inverter is that flat top box on the top.
Green motherboard.
Yeah, where you can see the circuit board on the top. Yeah.
So you guys, even though batteries are still really expensive, sounds to me like taking this integrated approach, you're taking a lot of cost out of these systems.
We are, and we're getting more performance out of them versus if we design just what we call an EDM, electric drive module, would just be the motor and the gearbox, and we make that just available generically to whoever would want to pair that up with their inverter. That inverter is not going to be designed in the software or the hardware to optimize the whole system efficiency in general. I mean, it might be, if we had enough information about the inverter, we could make a motor that would be matched to it. Typically, that's not going to be told to us because it comes from another source. And if we're making inverters as well, then, you know, that's not going to work out.
Is the inverter a generic piece, or does it specifically have to be matched to both the battery and the size of the e-machine?
That's a great question. The inverters are sold generically, and our company has a group that we just acquired called Sevcon from the UK. That's what they did. They sold inverters that could be flexibly applied to multiple motors. And you can do that to some degree. There'll be a range of motors where it will be maybe really well suited on the high end, say, because the inverter was designed for a very high power. And if you apply it with a smaller motor that can't handle as much current, it's kind of over-designed. You've built some things into this inverter that are underutilized. So ideally, you would like to have them pretty closely matched. And in our business, we really want the kind of product modularity that allows us to take an inverter family and expand it to the high end of that power range or the low end and use the same kind of building blocks. And I think that's generally what people do in the standalone inverter world. They either just make a one-size-fits-all and they take the good with the bad, or they tune it to try to get it to be higher power. They put larger current capacity switches in it if it's towards the high end and lower for the low end. But then there's also the aspect of the software. And the software has to be calibrated, not unlike engine calibration, things like that, to match it well to a given motor. So even if I make a one-size-fits-all set of hardware, the software will always have to be tuned to a given motor to make sure that it runs efficiently.
Mm-hmm. But it's a marvelous package, though. I mean, you got in my car, you have one motor in the rear-wheel drive Tesla. You got Rivian talking about putting four motors on each wheel. I mean, these are incredibly economical, efficient packages. And you talk to engineers about motors, and they say these are great little things as opposed to the complexity of a gasoline engine.
Right.
That's what you guys do. At BorgWarner, you make the motor inverter package, right?
Right.
But the limitation when everybody talks about the limitations of electric cars, they're really talking about batteries. They're not talking about the electric motor.
That's true. That's true. The batteries, that's a main cost driver for the electric powertrain, and it's probably the one that's got the most change coming to it in terms of cost, I would say, and which is a good thing because it's going down. And I think that the possibility of solid-state batteries makes that even look more optimistic, or the charge time, because that's, a barrier for some folks that don't want to spend so much time charging. And then there's also the possibility of going to 800 volts, let's say, with the current battery chemistry in order to overcome that charge time issue. But, the battery's definitely more of a focal point about adoption or not adoption, the rate of adoption, I should say, in EVs.
Yeah, that's where it's tricky. But the three of us, we've all been up to Sandy Monroe's shop, and he's torn down three EVs. He's got a bang, bang, bang right next to each other, a Tesla Model 3, a BMW i3, and a Chevy Bolt. And I was impressed in walking through those cars how impressed he was with the Tesla motor. Mm-hmm. He said this is one of the most advanced motors they have ever seen in terms of the magnets and whatnot. I mean, is somebody in the industry who are you impressed by the Tesla motor? I mean, how do you who's doing good work in the industry these days?
I think Tesla. The jury's still out for me on the Tesla, and I by the jury I mean us and BorgWarner. I think we're still evaluating whether the four magnets that are stacked up against each other are, doing the Halbach array, as they mentioned. That involves different magnetization angles. And to me, I think you have to go in and actually check that out. So I guess I still have to find out if that's the case. I haven't done that.
Yeah.
I think they've done a good job in the motor from what I've seen so far. They've made some steps to go to a silicon carbide inverter and that's moving the needle on technology for that. So, I think that's an interesting thing. However, the question is does it pay for itself in terms of cost?
Mm-hmm. Henry mentioning Rivian thinking about having wheel motors. Do you need four inverters, or is an inverter something that's a central device that then you just...
Yeah. You could co-locate all four, but you'd need four. If you had four motors, you'd need four inverters.
Why is that?
Because they operate independently. You'd want them to operate independently, I think.
So each wheel would be going at a different speed sort of thing?
You could do, for instance, torque steer if you wanted to.
Yeah, I think that's why Rivian's doing it.
Yeah.
Off-road machine, you can control each wheel independently.
Yeah. I mean,
cheap, though.
No. I've seen cases where people call a dual power module, something where they co-locate two inverters together for the same drivetrain, but and there might be advantages to that to share the same cooling system. Mm-hmm. If you had the space available, you might want to do it that way.
Mm-hmm. I just keep going back to John's idea of how do you make a hot rod electric vehicle. And so, okay, if we were making a hot rod car, mm-hmm. you know, with an internal combustion engine, we sort of know, you know, what the sweet spots would be. What would the sweet spot be in terms of, you know, just getting a, is it the size of the motor, e-machine,
yeah.
or the inverter, or the amount of power stored in the battery? I mean, what's the thing that someone would do?
Well, I think if you look at motorsports, for instance, there's Formula E and Formula One and things like that. They're not concerned about the cost of the materials as much as we are. They're not. They can use exotic steels that can carry more magnetic flux and things like that. They can ignore the acoustic noise aspects largely, and there are some trade-offs there. So we could program the inverter to run in a way that would generate more power, but at the expense of being noisier. Those are things that right away could be done. Another thing could be done is you could pump more coolant through at a faster rate. Now you get some pumping losses to deal with there when you do that.
But to cool down the motor.
Yes. Yeah. So it depends on where the weak link is. Is the motor unable to handle more? If let's assume it's continuous power. Depends on what we're trying to optimize. If this is a dragster, or you know, if we're going to something like a quarter mile, or if this is something where we want to be able to do a prolonged period of continuous power, mm-hmm. you know, Autobahn kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But you could do different things in the motor. Motors, generally, if you're trying to talk about small duration events, they just need a lot of mass to be able to hold the heat in, basically, without reaching too high of a temperature. For the inverters, 10 seconds is pretty much an eternity for an inverter, because if you can handle it for 10 seconds, you can probably do it all day. Maybe 30 seconds. But anyway, for motors, it's a very different story, because you can handle for short duration, you know, the whole ludicrous mode in the Tesla Model S, for instance. You can do things, you can hold your breath for just a little while before the temperatures reach, you know, levels that would damage insulation or bearings or things like that. Mm-hmm. You can't do that in the inverter so much. So the inverter would have to be designed with the full power in mind. Mm-hmm. You can eke out a little bit more power if you're willing to do it at the expense of acoustic noise. The motor, I think you have more knobs you could turn to soup it up.
Huh. Hey, let's go to the opposite end of the temperature spectrum. Jim Bilecki wrote in, and I'm just going to paraphrase it. You know, with the cold weather, especially the polar vortex, has been all in the national news and that.
Yeah.
Now everybody's aware that electric cars lose a lot of range in that regard.
Sure.
What are you working on at Borg, or are you working on anything that can help mitigate that?
Well, of course, means to keep the battery at its sweet spot so that it's operating most efficiently. That's so a battery heater, that kind of thing, but not necessarily changing the battery chemistry. Right now, that's out of the scope of what BorgWarner's doing. We're not involved in the battery.
More battery issues.
Yeah.
We'll let the battery guys worry about that, eh, Jim? Here's another one from Dave Tuttle, who's really into electric cars. He says, is there a rule of thumb trend for battery price per kilowatt hour? You know, in the electronics industry, there's Moore's Law. Is there any kind of rule of thumb with battery prices coming down?
I've seen projections. There's a nice one done by UBS. If you go out to UBS.com, where they, and these guys are, you know, basically in financial folks, right. So they don't really have a, I don't think they have a dog in that fight, but. So they can describe the trends of the, you know, but I don't see anything like a Moore's Law that anybody has come up with to suggest how pricing should come down, if there's kind of like some logic behind it rather than just expectation, you know, based on current slope. You know, what was it last year, and I'm going to extrapolate that. It's an interesting question. I bet somebody who was in the battery industry could comment on that better than I could.
Yeah.
Hey, one other thing that I found fascinating when I first met you is I was asking you, why do electric motors vibrate and make noise? If all you have is the stator that's spinning, I mean, what the heck? Mm-hmm. You told me this thing, I don't want to put the words in your mouth, but they kind of breathe.
Yeah.
Explain how that works.
Well, the stationary part of the motor. There's the rotor and the stator. The stator is the stationary part. Rotor is the rotating part. Stator is being pulled on by the rotor and like equal and opposite reaction on the rotor. But it's the stator part that really vibrates the most. And when we pull on the stator, it's not it can be non-uniformly. And so if I was to just take a stator, a round hoop of steel, let's say, about this long and this big around, which is about a traction motor, and we were to just set it on the table and hit it with a hammer, if we could somehow observe it, because it's going to be very small vibration, it would just egg shape. It would go back and forth between an oval in this direction and an oval in that direction. That's one mode shape possible. If we were to pull on that in multiple ways, if we could hit it like in two spots 90 degrees apart, we could get it to egg shape and or maybe make like a square kind of a shape and go in and out. There are other modes of vibration that these radial forces, the forces that pull inwards towards the center of the rotor, those things excite those modes of vibration. And when they do, those things are what transmit sound to us through just the air around it that's traveling, you know, those vibrations traveling through the air.
So when you say pulling on it, so this is electromagnetic forces that are pulling on it.
Right.
Rather than some physical thing that's exactly. pulling on it. It's yeah. not like a connecting rod or something.
Right. And remember, these are AC created forces, right? This person going up and down, if you will, in one spot.
The wave in the stadium.
Yeah, the wave is creating vibration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it creates it in multiple ways. It creates it at its own frequency, and the fact that this wave's going around causes that stator to distort and take on different shapes at a very small level, thousandths of an inch kind of, displacement.
And you guys are in Formula E, right?
We have done some Formula E work before in the SEVCON world, yes.
Yeah. Are you a supplier right now for any of the teams?
We currently aren't, no.
So when you go to a Formula E race, and I love racing not only because I got a need for speed, but also because engineers use that as a test bed for, you know, to push the limits for production. So you go to a Formula E race, and the electric motors are loud relative to what's in a production car.
Right.
And the Jaguar team has a noticeably different sound to their electric motor. It's a much higher frequency mm-hmm. shriek. So what would that be? Why would you hear different frequencies?
Well, one possibility is that they just use a higher maximum speed motor in order to get the motor size down. They use a higher gear ratio and a smaller mm-hmm. motor. So just the high end, they could be running at 20,000 RPM, and the next person maybe only 15,000. And I know some of the trends are to go even higher than 20,000 RPM on the Formula E. So you're going to be hearing a lot more shrill, I think, tones out of those drivetrains.
Yeah. Dogs are going to be howling.
Hey, Joey's cleaning lady wrote in. This is a good one. I wanted to ask it, too. Are you going to go to two-speed gearboxes? He says this has been the holy grail of top speed and low speed acceleration.
Yeah. That's a good question. It comes up at just about every conference on EV drivetrains, and it has been evaluated. We've looked at it in prototypes. We've looked at whether or not it pays for itself in terms of efficiency, because it does help. There are certain motors that don't want to go really fast but are great at the low end, and if you had two-speed gearboxes, that's especially attractive if you're going to try and do it in Europe and, you know, you've got Autobahn-type speeds.
Yeah.
Going with a single-speed gear ratio is, it's kind of confining that way. So we've tried that. So far, I've not seen, even though it does come out as a winner on efficiency, there's just almost been no takers yet. I mean, as far as I mean, I've not seen much pull from customers on that. They love the uninterrupted power. And it's amazing how spoiled you get, because a shift point in a standard transmission for an IC engine is probably a lot longer than what we're calling a shift point here. But of course, it's not. It's still a mechanical shift, but it's only one. You know, you said you get a 10-speed transmission or something. We all live with it just fine, but we can't handle one on an EV. But that's just the way things have worked out. People like the uninterrupted. I like it. I like the uninterrupted power.
Yeah. What factors into the engineering there? My car has a top speed. The Model 3 rear-wheel drive has a top speed of 125 miles an hour. If you get the dual-motor performance car, which people want to take to the track, that has a top speed of 155. Is that being governed because of the battery, because you want to reduce heat in the battery? What is governing top speeds in electric cars?
I couldn't tell you for Tesla how the choice was made. I mean, the top speed, if you're going with a single gear ratio, can be limited by the mechanical ability of the rotor to just stay intact. I mean, after a while, the centrifugal forces are really high, and you could just burst or fatigue the rotor.
So that's electric motor build.
Right. I mean, there are other possibilities that motor, because of the gear ratio that you need for low-end torque, you want a certain kind of 0 to 60 acceleration, let's say. So you want a lot of low-end torque, but you only have one gear ratio. So now what happens at high speed, you get very low torque for passing, let's say. And that may be something that they don't want to have to compromise. And you could design, if you have two motors on the same powertrain, you could design one motor that's sweet spot. It has fairly low end torque and high end torque. And of course, you'd have to design the rotor to be able to withstand those high speeds as well, and then have the other one be suited for low end torque. And between the two, you should be able to cover nicely, the whole drive range.
But for the two speed that John was asking about, this is basically a transmission versus having a separate motor or e-machine.
Right. Right.
So it'd be like shift up and then.
Yes.
Yeah. Look, we're coming to the end, but just before we wrap it up, I got to tell you, we had a guy who had converted a Corvette all electric. It has a 6-speed manual, and it's the wildest thing to drive an electric car that's got a 6-speed manual. And one of the best things is you can't stall the engine. But look, Dave Fulton, thanks so much for coming on the show. Very interesting. We're going to have you back at some point. I learned a lot, but I think we only scratched the surface. So,
all right.
Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a lot of fun having you here.
All right.
The world is changing at an ever-increasing pace. No matter what the mode of transportation, there is always the need for an efficient propulsion system. And that's exactly what BorgWarner has been doing since the earliest days of the automotive industry. We create innovative mobility technologies that reduce energy consumption and emissions while improving performance. Our proven track record has made us an leader in forward-looking propulsion solutions for combustion, hybrid, and electric vehicles.
Lear Kinexis offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
But I'm liking the fact that we're...
Okay, everybody shut up. We're back at the show.
Good to be back.
And this is the part of the show. And Jason, you probably don't even know this. Gary comes up with a number. This is Dr. Data now, by the way. He's going to come up with a number, and we're going to have to figure out what that number means.
Well, actually, this time is a little bit different. You get to pick a number. So I give you choices.
Oh.
Okay. So I figured that since we had Dave on the show, we were talking about electric vehicles, and we got Henry on the show, and this is something he's concerned with. So we'll just show what this is. So Katie, could you please bring up the number here? So this is the number of EV charging stations in both the United States and Canada, because the number for Canada is not that great additively to this thing. So do we have 15,000 and change, nearly 25,000, 38,000 and change, or 51, close to 52,000 charging stations?
I should know this because I write about it all the time.
You should, Henry. So these guys are going to depend on you for the answer to this question.
What's the answer, Henry?
Well, I know there's 150,000 gasoline stations around the country.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to go with 25.
Okay.
I go with the same number.
I'm going to go with 15,000.
Really?
Yeah.
We have a winner.
Uh-oh. Who is it?
Or do we have winners?
Katie?
Yes.
There you go.
Woohoo!
There you go.
25,000.
So, isn't it sort of interesting, though? I mean, you think about that, and I mean, how long does it take you to add a supercharger to charge?
Well, it depends on how much you need, but typically I plan for an hour.
An hour, okay.
Yeah.
So just think, as we have more and more electric vehicles, and we got people like Henry that are sitting there for an hour. I mean, it seems to me that we need to, like, geometrically increase the number of charging stations to make it reasonable for people to be able to have a normal life.
Great.
Right. Well, and the other piece of that is you hear Porsche and Audi who are coming to market with their high-end EVs, and their customers don't want to sit at a charger for an hour. They want to sit there for 10 minutes, and the suck from the power grid of that kind of electricity going into a car is big. I mean, it puts real stresses on infrastructure. So there are a lot of questions beyond just the number of stations.
Did you say suck on the show?
I did.
Yeah.
no control.
You can say anything on the show. Joey's cleaning lady wants to know, were those public charging stations?
Yes.
That number. Okay. So. Yeah, but, you know, going back to what Henry said, you know, the Porsche, you know, liquid-cooled cable and blah, blah, that's only at dealerships, right?
In terms of the charging station.
Right. I mean, the Uber Fast, blah, 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 blah. My understanding is Porsche is only going to have it at its dealerships.
Well, they're advertising.
Drive to the dealer to charge your car?
They're advertising this is going to be part of Electrify America's network.
Oh, is it? Okay.
So right now, the state of the art are the Tesla superchargers that are 120 kilowatt hour. We got to get Dave back on the show to explain what that means. But that's the state of the art. I mean, your average charger is more like 75 kilowatt hour, and so these high end stations are talking about getting 100 miles in 15 minutes in a charge. You're looking at, I think these are like 180, 240 kilowatt stations. I mean, they put real loads on the utility infrastructure. So I don't know how many of those you can do. In a locality.
We drove the original electric T-Van at Chrysler from Detroit to L.A. with Jim Healy of USA Today. But behind it was a Dodge Ram pickup with a
generator,
diesel generator on the back that we would recharge the vehicle. We just destroyed the environment all along the way.
So, Gary, what news should we jump into here?
Well, we've got several things to talk about. One of the things that sort of interests me is, you know, we saw reporting, and you probably did some of this, Henry, about the people are not paying their car loans as efficiently as they might, and that we're at a point that goes back to 2009 in terms of delinquencies and paying off loans.
Oh.
Then we have the weakening of, you know, the car market on a global basis. And the thing that I wonder about is, are we going to come to a point where we're going to reach a crisis of affordability that is going to completely, you know, make 2008, 2009 look like happy days are here again?
You mean, in this case, with the price of cars just keep going, well, they're going to go up, man.
Right.
Now, this electric stuff we've all
been
talking
about. I mean, everybody's talking about all this stuff that is, and everybody wants bigger vehicles, and they want fancier vehicles, and they want more stuff in their vehicles, but they seem to be unable to necessarily afford these things, right? So, I mean, at what point does it get where people say, well, gee, we'd really like one, but somebody says, well, I can't sell it to you, John, because you just don't have the money to afford this thing. And we only have these fancy ones now. I mean, it's just like, you know, when a new car would come out and it would say, you know, starts at $15,999, and you go to the dealer and say, I'd like to see that $15,999 one. We don't have one of those, but I got this $25,000 one I can show you in the back. I mean,
Jason, you were inside big auto companies. I mean, how did they adjust for these economic waves? How did they look at lease and buy and rental? And used car rates.
It all goes to residual values. When we were at Ford, our lease rates for Lincolns were higher than BMW 5s because the residual value of the Lincoln was garbage. But I've been in the open market for the last 5 or 6 years. I'm blown away the price of a Wrangler. A Jeep Wrangler, you can spend up to $55,000. Yeah. I ended up buying a Jeep Cherokee a couple of years ago because the Grand Cherokee was $45,000. I got a Jeep Cherokee for $28,000. It's a problem I've always had with the auto industry, and try to explain it to my wife, that she sees the ad, the newspaper, $199, and there's not one, there may be one, but it's got pigeon stuff on it.
Right.
And the real cost is $350. But the cost of an automobile still, I think if you do the economics compared to what it was 20 years ago, it's still very affordable, seeing how inflation has gone and incomes have gone. But I think we're actually at a tipping point where cars are getting out of cost.
Well, look, we priced a lot of people out of the market. I keep pointing this out, that a smaller percentage of the American public is now buying a new car. Hmm. And if we went back to just the year...
Even at 17 million?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
These record high numbers, the percentage of the population.
Listen to this, Henry. In the year 2000, we sold 17 million new cars. Mm-hmm. Here we are, 2018, 18 years later, we sold 17 million new cars. The population of the United States has gone up by 2.5 million people every single year since then. We now have 45 million more people living in the U.S., and we're selling the same number of cars that we did in the year 2000. Hmm. Now, several things going on.
I start calling you Dr. Data. That's pretty good data.
You're missing the point that cars have gotten so much better that they last a lot longer.
Yeah, but I've got to tell you, that's a factor, no question about it. But if people had the ability to buy new, they'd be buying new. We've created an opportunity for them to buy used, especially at certified, pre-owned. And there's a lot of good used stuff out there. But people are being priced out and have been being. In fact, if you want to look at the highest percentage of people in the U.S. who ever bought a new car, it was in 1978. Mm-hmm. And so if you just go back to the year 2000 and the same percentage of people bought a car, the SAR wouldn't, or, you know, the sales wouldn't be 17 million. It'd be about 22, pushing 23 million. So we are pushing people out of the market.
Well, you said the highest sales were 1978. In 1979, we had no sales because the economy went into the crapper.
Right.
And we went through a recession for 3 years.
Right.
We also have an instance where kids are waiting longer to get their licenses, mm-hmm. and longer to buy a car. We got the use of Uber and Lyft and so forth. And some people think, especially in urban areas where young people like to live, they think they don't need to have a car.
All true. And, you know, that's another factor in a smaller percentage buying new cars. But I still maintain the biggest thing is the price. I mean, I look at some of these lease rates, and it's like, how do people afford this?
Right. I mean, so is this, does this provide the opportunity for a car maker to come in with truly economy vehicles?
Yeah, cue the Chinese.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there was that, that company Zotye was at the NADA, and they were trying to sign up people to be dealers for their vehicle. Yeah, I mean, that's real. But, I mean, do you think anybody's looking at this? I mean, Jason,
I hope they're looking at it because I'm worried about the industry, to be honest. I think people are going to start saying, "I, as John says, I just can't afford this. I'm going to keep my vehicle longer."
Mm-hmm. But here's the problem. Nobody can make money on an entry-level car. And it costs almost as much to build an entry-level car from a tooling cost at CapEx investment, right, than it does to build an upscale car. It's going to cost you $1 billion to build a low-price car. Now you're not going to make any money on it. And then you're going to go to the board and say, hey, I need another $1 billion to replace it. They're going to go, forget it.
So AutoLine After Hours will be over in a year.
Now we'll get advertising from Uber or something.
Yeah.
Well, but to that point, I mean, so Uber lost $1.8 billion last year, okay? And Didi, the Chinese company that's also, you know, that basically drove Uber out of the China market, it also lost $1.8 billion last year. I mean, so here we have these ride-hailing companies that are also losing money.
Yeah, they're all autonomous business models. They're
meaning what?
They only make money when you go to autonomous.
Well, I take Ubers every time to the airport, and if you talk to the drivers, they go, I won't have a job in 5 years. Because when the autonomous cars come, this is just a temporary thing where I'm driving you. pretty soon it's going to be autonomous cars picking you up.
Right.
And that's what they're fearful of, but they're trying to make, you know, $7 a ride right now. It's an incredible market right now. But your talk of losing money right now with Uber, think about Amazon back in, I think, 98 in California. I remember just hearing that they're losing $300, $400, $500 million, $700 million and thinking, how can they sustain themselves as their stock? And now look at Amazon. It took over the world.
Right.
So for them, it's the long view. Mm-hmm. And
that's the Valley model. I mean, look at how many years Tesla lost money. And it was only Elon Musk's ability to raise money independently that kept the company going
and
to where it's now profitable.
Yes, and government subsidy.
Well, yeah, look, everybody in the EV business has been subsidized in some way or other. But as everybody keeps pointing out online, oil companies get subsidies too, so what the heck?
I'm looking for one.
So what happens if we take these two things, okay, which seem independent, perhaps aren't, okay? So we have vehicles that are, you know, according to Kelley Blue Book, January average transaction price was over $37,000, okay? So people cannot afford to buy vehicles. Then we have the situation where we have Ubers, but they're going to become autonomous, okay? So the first thing is going to drive down the number of vehicles that people are going to buy because they simply don't have the money. The second thing is going to drive down the number of vehicles that are needed because if we have autonomous Ubers rolling around, you know, they don't need to take a break for lunch like the guy who takes you to the airport does, which is also going to drive the number of vehicles down. What happens to the industry?
All right. I mean, that's what makes it such a fascinating time. I mean, we don't know what the end games are. I mean, we know that the Uber Lyft end game is autonomous. That's how their business models are built on an autonomous ride-sharing economy. But we don't know when that's going to arrive. And you know, there are all kinds of regulatory hurdles. I think that's why GM is so fascinating to watch because they've basically taken their president, Dan Ammann, and put him in charge of a autonomous company, Cruise, because they see a future where they potentially could just become cell phone makers. They'll just be a hardware maker and talk about low margins. They want to be in the subscription business, and so they've said that's where the money is going to be made in that game. And so here is General Motors, an automobile company, building a vertical ride-sharing business in Cruise because they want to be able to model making money on subscriptions like AT&T and Verizon does. I mean, that's a radical shift for
completely,
an automobile
totally,
company.
Completely, totally. So what GM says, too, just to build on what you said, is it earns in revenue, on average, $30,000 for every vehicle it sells globally. With autonomous ride-sharing, GM says it thinks it can make $300,000 in revenue on each one of those vehicles.
Yep.
But the number of vehicles will
go down.
So does it go down such that it becomes comparable that they're you know, at the end of the day they're making the same amount?
Because the margins are way better in autonomous ride-sharing. You know, you build a vehicle and you use it with many, many people giving you all this kind of money for it, and then you can refurbish it and keep it going for years, too. So, you know, the margin, there's estimates all out there. But, you know, GM on average right now in North America with all its pickups and everything makes about a 10% profit margin. Mm-hmm. The belief is that with autonomous ride sharing, the profit margins would be 20 to 25%.
You know, that's in some respects not new. I've been in the industry since 83. And I have always heard this stat, and I know if it's true, that 60% of the profit of a car comes after it's sold, whether it's repair or resale and so forth. So, mm-hmm. But what I will say is, you know, when people say this is the most important election I've seen in my life, this is the most important 5 years I've seen in the auto industry going forward to see how it transpires.
Right.
I really believe that.
Oh, no, I totally agree with you, Jason. I think that the industry is on very thin ice. There's going to be huge winners. There's going to be a lot of losers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and to sort of close the circle on your Amazon comment about the Amazon taking over the world, we had this week or last week, an announcement that Amazon invested $700 million in an automobile company. And it's a startup automobile company called Rivian. And we're all trying to figure out why is that? Why is Amazon just invested in Rivian?
Do you have Prime?
I do have Prime.
Do you see those trucks rolling around, those Sprinter vans with those nice smiles on the side?
Yeah.
Just imagine if they were electric.
Yeah. Is that it? I mean, is that the game?
Yeah.
That's what they're doing. Because
yeah.
Rivian, because you talk to Rivian, and Rivian's all about, we're going after the Range Rover customer. We've got an electric pickup truck or SUV that is going to knock the socks off of high-end customers. We're competing with Tesla. Yeah.
Well,
what you just said is a totally different business equation than
that. No. Well, I think Gary's right, but I think there's another element. So you're right. Rivian's business model is they want to be the North Face, the Patagonia of action-adventure vacations.
Yep.
So if you want to take your family on a kayaking trip, a whitewater rafting trip, a skiing trip, whatever, they'll present you with the entire vacation with all the equipment that you need and the vehicle to drive in. Now imagine if you're Amazon and going, ooh, they can buy all this equipment too? So I think it's have the electric delivery trucks plus tie in with Rivian's business model and say, hey, all you rich people that are going to take all these expensive vacations, look at all the cool stuff you can buy on Amazon.
Well, you know, and another thing, and this goes to Jason's point about autonomy, that what didn't get as much attention is the fact that Jeff Bezos put a big pile of money in the autonomous vehicle technology developer Aurora, the one that Chris Urmson started, right?
And so, Urmson's the real deal. He's
right.
the real
yeah.
player in this tech.
Yeah, the original guy who
right. yeah, so he,
for Google.
Yeah, yeah so right. he was there and then he left and he started his own. So think about that. So suddenly you've got these trucks that are driving in your neighborhood to, you know, bring you whatever it is you get to. I don't even want to imagine, but and they're autonomous. So yeah, a lot of big changes happening.
Hey, we're getting down towards the end of the show, but we got a number of questions for Jason here, including a phone call. Carmen, let's bring in that phone call.
Hi, John. Dale Leonard out of Cleveland, Ohio. Just have a quick question for Jason. Wonder if he is writing any new books or if he has written one. Just asking. Very interested. Miss him. Great show as always. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call. I'm in the process of writing a book about the Viper. And there's been various books about the Viper, but this is not a car book. This is about a team of renegades that volunteered for their positions and put their careers on the line to develop a car that never made a dime but saved the company. Because back in 91, we at Chrysler were on fumes. We were waiting for the Grand Cherokee. We were waiting for a new Ram pickup truck because the old one was built, I think, by Henry Ford. And we still didn't have the second generation of the minivan, which was reintroduced by my brother-in-law, Chris Theodore. But the fact that we could think of producing a car like this, working with Carroll Shelby and Bob Lutz and so forth, it was inspirational. And I got to be the PR guy for the team. And so I actually was speaking to the retirement organization at Chrysler yesterday, and this is going to be a book by Jason Vines and Team Viper. But it's the inside story, and it's very, very funny. I'm very excited about this book. My first book was hard to write because I'm ADHD. My second book was easy to write because I got to work with my buddy here, Henry Payne, who did the cover.
Yeah, it's a good collaboration.
And the third book, The Last American CEO, about how Chrysler bought AMC. But this book is kind of a labor of love, and it's been fun writing it already, and it should be out in the fall.
Okay, we got another viewer wrote in. Michael Shipley from Ridgely, Maryland says, tell Jason, I thoroughly enjoy his books. I just bought Jimmy Hoffa Called My Mom a Bitch to read on vacation. He says, I also recommend What Did Jesus Drive and The Last American CEO.
I really appreciate that. And once again, to Henry, the cover of Jimmy Hoffa Called My Mom a Bitch. Henry.
My best book cover ever.
Oh, it's just incredible because when I went. Can I have 30 seconds to tell
the
story?
Yeah. Tell the story.
Gabby Gifford gets shot in Arizona. Remember the Arizona?
Yeah, right.
And President Obama goes there and gives the tribute, a memorial service, and called for a new era of peace or whatever in America. And I thought, you know, good for you. Well, fast forward to Labor Day in Detroit, the UAW thing rally down in downtown Detroit on Labor Day, and Jimmy Hoffa Jr. is there, and Obama's behind him, and he's saying, we got to kill those Republicans, sons of bitches. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, he's talking about me. I'm a son of a bitch. Wait a minute, Jimmy Hoffa just called my mom a bitch. And so I wrote my column for Henry's political website for the Detroit News. We didn't use the B word, but he goes, when we put the book together of all the columns.
That's the title.
This is the title. And he not only did the cover, but every chapter, and I take on Republicans and Democrats and atheists and Christians and so forth, has one of his cartoons around the same time about the subject, and it's a fun read. If you're a liberal, you'll hate the book. If you're a conservative, you'll love it, and you'll laugh, and it's PG-13 as opposed to what, there it is.
There's Henry's cover.
I mean, that's Henry's cover. That's just beautiful. And when I did interviews on the radio, they didn't
great
know
cover,
if they could
title.
Use the B word. But, you know, you can say anything anymore. But that's a fun read, and it's an easy read. If you're a guy, you can do it on about 2.5 hours on the toilet.
Okay, we got one more here. And as a little bit of background for anybody who's listening right now, Jason, you may have gotten the impression, worked in public relations at the Chrysler Corporation. You were the vice president of corporate communications for the Ford Motor Company. Doesn't get any higher than that in that profession. And you were the head of corporate communications for Nissan here in the U.S. Did you work with Ghosn?
I was there for 2 years, the last year for him as a de facto head of PR for.
Okay.
And I was in Nissan three times a month.
Okay. So Robert from Portland, Oregon, just wants to know, what do you think about the Carlos Ghosn situation?
Well, if you read my book, What Did Jesus Drive? There's a big section on this whole thing about going to Nissan and then working with Carlos. And I was in his office about a week before we announced the Nissan Revival Plan, which changed the Japanese auto industry. It was just me and him, and he goes, you know, these idiots think they're going to get their company back in a year. They think this is just temporary.
These idiots meaning
the
Nissan.
Japanese.
Yeah.
And I love the Japanese, by the way, and I enjoyed working with Nissan. So we announced the Nissan Revival Plan, which changed the company. It saved the company, thanks to Carlos Ghosn and the team. 20 years later, they finally think they can get the company back. And this is nothing more than a coup. He may have done some stupid things financially, but it seems like he got approval to do so. I'm incredibly disappointed that Renault has abandoned him, because if not for Nissan surviving, Renault would not have survived. So the fact that they've thrown him to the wolves, I believe he's got some great lawyers now. He supposedly has the Johnny Cochran of Japan.
The razor.
And he will be exonerated, or he may be convicted and thrown out in Japan. But when he goes to file lawsuits, he'll be more fabulously wealthy than he ever thought of with the funds he supposedly was stockpiling for the future.
Yeah, so what you're saying is, you know, matter what court case decision comes out, guilty, not guilty, he'll leave Japan.
He'll leave Japan.
And sue the company.
He'll sue them. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, whether it's an international court or the Ninth Court of Appeals in San Francisco or wherever. This guy's going to be fabulously wealthy and make his family. And I'm very disappointed in my former company, Nissan, how they shat on him early. I'm just disgusted by the Japanese legal system that makes Saudi Arabia look non-hostile. He will win, and Nissan is already losing financially by this, and shame on them.
So explain the coup. So Renault, at the very beginning, thought, we'll hook up with Nissan and eventually take them over 100%.
Let me give you the whole story. So Renault is in dire... Nissan is in dire straits. When I got there, I was lied to. They were beyond bankruptcy. So much so that Japan, the country, gave them $500 million under the table in a loan they didn't have to pay back. Daimler Chrysler, with Jürgen Schrimp, comes in. He wants to buy them. Has a secret trip over to Japan to look under the kimono and realizes, ooh, it's not good, but he still wants to buy it. He comes back to Germany, and Dieter Zetsche makes the case, we can't do this. So at the last minute, the 11th hour, we are a bride at the altar, and Daimler Chrysler pulls away from us, saying, we thought, we're done. No one wants to buy us. But Nissan, with Ghosn, and who was Louis
Schweitzer.
They were waiting, because Renault needed it. They sweep in, buy 34.5% share, which we're legally to do, a controlling share, and saves Nissan, because we were out of gas, completely out of gas. Ghosn closes 5 plants, which was a no-no.
In Japan, yeah.
Ghosn's coming in as the Renault CEO.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's coming in and taking...
No, he's coming in as the Nissan CEO. Louis Schweitzer is still running Renault at this point.
Yeah. But he's appointed by Renault.
He's appointed by Renault. He closes 5 plants. He destroys the Keiretsu system. And interestingly, he closes the corporate brothel just outside of headquarters. So a French guy closes a whorehouse.
Yeah.
Figure. But the company comes back in full Monty. And because they got so strong, they were able to funnel money to Renault, which was suffering it in Europe. So Renault survived because of Nissan. And now they want to take over. This is 20 years later, but Nissan finally says, we want our company back.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and this is the blunt end of the business. I mean, this is where nationalities meet and really hard business decisions are made, like throwing Ghosn under the bus. But I think what's cool about the book, about that section of the book, is it's very personal. I mean, you're talking about these executives meeting each other for the first time. You're behind the scenes and setting up how corporate statements are going to be made, and there are big egos and big national cultural images at stake, and it's a fascinating look at these cultural forces that are breaking apart the company and throwing Ghosn to the wolves. But it's really on a just a very personal anecdotal level that section of Where Did Jesus Drive is really good.
And it's funny because I told Ghosn, because I would be with him until 9 o'clock at night. I go, when I leave here, I run to the hotel, which was 2 blocks away. He goes, why do you run? He goes, because I'm afraid one of these bastards is going to try to kill themselves by jumping out of the headquarters and they'll land on me. But we had death threats, and I told him to increase security. We had death threats every day because we were breaking up Japan. And before the announcement, I said, what headline do you want tomorrow? I go, we're changing Japan Inc. And he did the NPR, we call it, the Nissan Revival Plan, NRP. Sorry. Yeah. And the next day in the Japan Times, headline, Changing Japan Inc. And I was like, yes. Yeah. So, and we did. It really shook up the industry.
It did. But as you point out, it saved Nissan.
It saved
Nissan.
Which
in turn saved Renault, really.
It saved thousands of jobs in Nashville.
Here's the thing that I see is that it's an imbalanced relationship. You know, Nissan is way bigger, more profitable, technically more advanced than Renault. Renault would dispute that, especially the last one, but it's true. And so Nissan's going, wait a minute. We have no say in this relationship. We have no voting power in Renault. Renault's got controlling interest of us. Plus, the French government owns a chunk of Renault, and what do they want? Two things. They want as many jobs in France as possible, and they want as many taxes paid in France as possible. So I think Nissan was going, wait a minute, we're seeing decisions being made that benefit France, don't necessarily benefit Nissan. We need a more equitable relationship. I think the French didn't want to hear it, and so Nissan took a hostage. And that's where we're at today.
It's sad that they took this hostage and they did it in this way.
Right. Yeah, it's ugly. It's really ugly. It's sad
how the Japanese government is acting with their.
But it's an imbalance. It's a flawed marriage, and flawed marriages do not last. I believe Renault has got to step up and do something to make it more equitable, or it's going to win the battle and lose the war.
I think you're probably right on that one. They should just send some croissants.
Some croissants and camembert.
but it's interesting. I mean, these tensions were there from the beginning, and now they're exploding. But it also makes it interesting when these cross national mergers work, like Fiat buying Chrysler. You know, that has been a success.
But I would say, yeah, they bought it completely, and look who's running the company now.
Oh, yeah.
It's mostly the Chrysler guys.
Yeah.
You know, so it's about, I've not heard anybody in Auburn Hills complain, those damn Italians.
No,
maybe it's being said behind closed door, but I don't hear that at all.
Either. And then I have friends. Do I have 30 seconds?
Yeah, go. We're going to have to wrap up.
The night before the Nissan revival plan, Ghosn presented in front of the board of directors. And he had the Q&A that we put together. And I said, don't allow the Japanese to say, get rid of that question, because we don't like the answer. I go, that's what they do. He comes back after the meeting. He goes, take these questions out. I go, I told you not to do this. He goes, Jason, you idiot. I know the answers. I just don't need them on paper.
That's pretty good. Look, clearly there's going to be a whole lot more to talk about this whole situation, and we will talk about it on Out of Line After Hours. But I think we're going to have to wrap it up now. I know Ford is just about to announce some big news, so we'll have to see what that's all about.
Maybe with VW.
Yeah, could
yeah,
be.
Yeah.
Maybe they sprung Ghosn out of jail.
Yeah. See how Dearborn and the Germans get along.
Go to another perfect.
Yeah, another merger.
But Jason, great having you on the show.
It's great.
Whenever you're back in town, let us know, and let us know ahead of time.
No, I'm staying here in your house.
Oh, I'll let my dogs know. My wife won't mind. But Henry, great having you on the show.
Thanks, John. Yeah, thanks for having me, as always.
And Gary, let's do it again.
Okay.
You got the whole show next week.
Right.
I'm going to be out of town.
Right.
So.
Where are you going?
I'm going to Europe.
Mm.
So. Going to be there all.
I'm going to this chair here. So
right. So anyway, great show, guys, and of course, want to thank all of you in the audience for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems, and by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
Visit our website, outofline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Out of Line Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Out of Line This Week. There's all that and much more at outofline.tv.
Yeah. Another Bill Ford hobby horse.
Well, it sounds good, though, doesn't it?
I have a great line to share that I shared at the Chrysler retirement speech yesterday. I got it from my brother-in-law. We were watching TV yesterday morning, and a commercial came on. You've probably seen it. A Place for Mom. Have you seen this?
Joan London.
I haven't. I've heard about it.
With Joan London.
Yeah.
And he goes, Place for Mom. Why isn't there a place for Dad? It just broke the group up.
Yeah.
Are we done? Are we still on air?
No, it's still live, but
Hey,
the official show is over.
Sorry to have to use all my Spartan gear, but...
Well, you know, it's pathetic, but I know there's no talking you out of it.
No, there's not. I got Spartan underwear on.
We'll take that on faith. Oh. It was funny. When I was driving over here, there was a young lady who was driving a 200, and she must have been recent high school graduate because she had one of her tassel hanging, you know, from her mortar board on the, mm-hmm. the rearview window. And in one hand, she was eating a giant hoagie, which looked very good, by the way. And in the other hand, she had a beverage. And I was thinking, gee, it'd be nice if there was autonomous vehicles, because I was wondering, what would happen if she got a phone call?
Right.
I remember a few years ago driving up Telegraph Road around 12 Mile, young lady and a navigator had a banana in one hand and the phone in the other. It just...
Just getting potassium and...
And a message.
Yeah. You know, it's... I'm writing on this for the news, but you don't need to put your phone in your hand anymore. You know, I got a $26,000 Hyundai Elantra in the driveway, and you can talk to it. It'll do everything through voice command. But I'm amazed how many people I talk to who own a new Hyundai Elantra, even a $50,000 BMW, and I say, isn't adaptive cruise great, or isn't voice control great? And they'll say, what's that? Mm-hmm. And they don't know the tech. And it seems to me the dealers are so bad
You're
at communicating.
You're exactly right. My wife has been a proponent of this. She, you know, once in a while I'll start the car up, and she gets a call from her sister, and it comes into the car because she has adopted this. Uh-huh. Me, I don't. Mm-hmm. However, I just don't talk on the cell phone
right. When
I'm driving.
Well, I can't believe how many people I see on their phone, and I know their car allows you to pair the phone to the car.
Right.
So you can drive hands-free.
That's right. And you just talk to it and say, call this number, because all the contacts sync up. I just don't think people know a lot of these things. But and a Car and Driver did a piece this week, and they were testing the Kona EV against the Bolt EV. And they were doing it in California. They're doing it in optimal weather. And they were struck by driving along and trying to find charging stations. So many of them are dealer-based. And they would drive into a dealer, and the dealer would have the charger blocked by a utility vehicle. You know, they're so underutilized.
Yep.
And then when somebody actually wants to use them, the dealer... Employees haven't been trained not to, you know, not just to park a car mm-hmm. over there in the space. So, you know, even where you find infrastructure, there's no guarantee that you'll be able to use it.
Back to the texting thing. I remember about 6 years ago, I think Eddie Alterman at Car and Driver called me. He goes, we're going to start. We did a test. We had one of our drivers, I don't know, they were at Proving Grounds, maybe Chrysler, and they increasingly got him drunk to see how he could drive.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then 2 days later, they had him do the same course texting. And he did worse texting.
Man.
And he goes, we're going to do a story about how texting is worse than drunk driving. I go, holy moly. Watch out. You're going to get attacked by mad. Say that they're both problems. And don't... Try to say, don't try to minimize drunk driving.
Right. Smart advice.
And they took my advice. And it was a fairly big story. But I got to tell you, I see it everywhere now.
Yeah.
And, you know, even in Troy where it's illegal. You know, here's the problem. This is how our government officials don't think. So when Troy put the ban on texting and driving in, what did the young people do? They held their phones lower, which meant their eyes were off the road longer.
But, you know, Henry, I'll tell you what the problem is. You go to buy a new car, it takes forever. And, you know, you get done speccing out the car and everything like that, and then you haggle over a price. Then you got to go to the F&I guy, and the whole rigmarole. Now you're there several hours.
Four. Yeah.
And you just want to get out of there. And the salesman, all cheerful souls, hey, I'll show you the whole infotainment system. And you're like, even if you pay attention, your mind's mush. And all you're thinking is, I want to get in this brand new car and go home and show everybody.
Yeah.
So you don't learn any of the stuff. In fact, a lot of dealers try to do follow-up a couple of weeks later to say, come on back. We know that you weren't paying attention when we tried to teach you this. But come on back and we'll run you through it. You'd be amazed at how many people go, no thanks, they don't want to be bothered by it.
Well, why can't they have a system where when you get in the car, when you first buy it, it goes, it's like an infomercial. This is how everything works. And you have to do
because
it.
I got to get to the airport. Right. Shut up, stupid car.
So Henry, this is sort of like if you have Microsoft Office, right, there are enormous number of things that it can do besides processing words and making Excel spreadsheets and PowerPoint presentations.
All people want to be able to know is that, how to
That's just it. And, you know, and all this other stuff, I mean, and you're paying for it and, you know, it's
there. I just learned
there.
Something.
And, yeah, I mean, so you got all that stuff there. I mean, and you know, to what you're saying, what John's saying, is that, okay, so let's say that if you're using Gmail and Gmail has a new update, and they'll throw these screens. Look what you can do with Gmail. It's like, who looks at that? It's just like sweep, swipe, swipe.
Well, right. I got to tell you, I'm afraid of some of this. I'll get an update from Dell saying, we want to update you. And I've been burned by that, by fake updates. So you're thinking, is this real?
Mm-hmm.
Or this is a Windows update. Is this real? Or are they just trying to get into your...
Well, look, the solution is YouTube videos. I mean, if you've ever tried to do something at home or whatever, and you go, oh, hey, wait, I wonder if there's a YouTube video. Of course there's a YouTube video. And some of them are really good, and it's people just posting this stuff. There's a ton of stuff about Teslas, and both by the factory and by the users. So that's the solution in today's world. Nobody reads the owner's manual. You know, the stinking owner manual.
I haven't done that for 30 years.
They're 350 pages long on average, and more than half of it is legal disclaimers. So no one looks at the owner's manual. All you need are simple YouTube videos.
So it just so happens that I had to pull a owner's manual out of a vehicle that I was driving on Friday. So I have a Cadillac XT4. And you know how if you shut the ignition off that the radio continues to play, right?
Mm-hmm. Right? I like that.
Until you open the door.
Okay, you open the door and it shuts off. So I get out of the car, shut the door. It's still playing. And I'm like, this can't be good, because I'm thinking...
It wasn't in park?
Yeah, the car was shut. Yeah.
It was in park, it was and in you park. Turned it off.
I turned it off, got out of the car.
The radio's still on.
And, you know, hit the button to lock the doors, and the radio's still playing. And I'm like, how do I shut this off? And so I get the book out. And so this is one of the things, because I think that OEMs know that people no longer read the manuals. And so what they basically are doing is instead of writing specific manuals for specific vehicles, that they're doing sort of like an omnibus thing. So I'm pull the thing out, and you know, it's XT4, and it says, go to audio system, because I want to see, you know, make sure this thing is shut off, because I'm thinking if it's sitting in the driveway, it's playing all night, fuck it out.
Run the battery down.
Run the battery down. For all audio systems, except for XT4.
Is that right?
Right. So then I had to go find another booklet to try to find out just how to shut the damn thing off.
Huh. It's what we call an RTFM problem. Read the effing manual.
But it still didn't get me anywhere.
But it, you know, it goes back to your point about the market pricing, outpricing customers. I mean, there's an opportunity, I think, for a brand, and it's one reason Tesla wants to own its own dealership, so you have a uniform sales experience. But I think what the Japanese and the Koreans are doing really well right now is they're standardizing all this stuff. Not just the Apple CarPlay and the phone, but also the adaptive cruise, the automatic windshield wiper.
Well, Hyundai and Kia are brilliant at it.
Right.
And they're the best.
Right. So if you bring the customer in in their first buy experience, which is what an Elantra or a Honda HR-V is, and you go through the standard stuff, and people are going to say, wow, you're telling me I can hook up my phone, and now I never have to worry about the Troy police again. They're going to appreciate that brand and that dealer. I mean, it's an enormous opportunity because these electronic systems are really good.
Yeah, no, and that's what I meant is Hyundai Kia are doing the best job of putting this technology in low-price cars.
Yeah.
I mean, better than Honda, Toyota, or any of the others, too. Yeah.
So okay. I got pulled over in California, what town, north of L.A., where Ronald Reagan was. Why can't I think of it?
Malibu?
Huh?
Malibu.
Doesn't matter. Just tell the story.
I got pulled over. My wife and I are out there.
Because you had your phone on?
Yeah. And they go, hey, where are you from? I go, Detroit. And he goes, it's illegal to have your phone on.
Yeah, the real Nazis out there.
Oh. But they didn't give me a ticket.
But, so just imagine, though, I mean, Henry, what if somebody comes out with a car that is, or crossover, whatever you want it to be, and it's bare bones. Basically, all you do is you have your phone, whether it's running Android or running iOS, it doesn't matter. You just plug the thing in, and all of the apps are there. And there are apps that are specific that, you know, that the guys at Google or the guys at Apple write for each thing you want to do. You want to text in your car, there it is. If you want the windshield wipers to be intermittent, there it is. You want the, you know, the cruise, there it is. Yeah. Because people will learn that stuff because they have their phone with them all the time.
Right.
And they're constantly looking at it. Right. Right?
And that's what Tesla does. When you walk in and buy the Tesla, that's the first thing they do. Is they run through all that stuff. They do all those settings for you. So here's how you pair your phone. Here's how all this automatic stuff the car does for you. Here's the button you press so you talk to it. That's
right.
Like
but I mean, but to John's point, I mean, you just want to run out of there screaming. You just want to get the car and go.
I say, though, Jeff Gordon Chevrolet in Wilmington, when we bought a Equinox, they took the time to do that.
Yeah, a lot of dealers.
I think that's brilliant because then you'll go back to them.
Yeah. No, in fact, I want to say Penske with his Lexus dealerships has been doing that and his Mercedes dealerships. Can we pair your phone for you? Can we program your home address in, blah, 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 for the nav and whatnot? Mm-hmm. But, you know, the problem with taking your phone and just using apps, which CarPlay and Android Auto kind of let you do, is the car companies are scared shitless of cyber, you know. How do they know that that app is hard? You know, so you can only use limited apps, even on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto, because they want to search the hell out of making sure that it's not a gateway into hacking. Into
that's the next cyber threat, is taking control of your vehicle.
Right.
Yeah.
Whether opening it up or making it go out of control. And I'm not trying to conspiracy theories, but.
Yeah, just brick it.
The way they can, they're doing it today on a daily basis in all other parts of our society.
Right.
They could create havoc in our car park.
Yeah.
Well, look, the intelligence community increasingly is talking of a cyber Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Who's the author? Gladwell, Malcolm Gladwell.
So ending things here on an up note.
That, yeah.
yeah.
But I saved 15% on Geico.
Yeah.
But he talks to Intel people a lot about that. That's a big concern. And we wrote last week that GM now has 4 defense people on their board.
Yeah.
They're
including the chairman of the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the former deputy director of the CIA.
Yeah, and we're thinking there's overlap there with going into autonomous cars.
Oh, you know, you're getting too conspiratorial here.
This I don't think has been reported either. You know, GM just created GM Defense. They've just created a new division. Hmm. And I don't think
so. Basically, they want to sell tanks. Come on,
they do.
I mean.
Called Suburbans. Yeah.
wasn't the tank plant once a Chrysler plant?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah.
Right.
It's General Dynamics?
Yeah, out in Sterling Heights.
Yeah. So.
Well, that one's not even General Dynamics anymore. That's TankCom. And
we had defense down in Louisiana.
No. Lima, Ohio.
But we had also defense down in outside of New Orleans.
Okay.
So car companies and defense stuff are.
Well,
just,
hey, arsenal of democracy.
Yeah.
This is why I lobbied for the bailout of Chrysler and GM with the dealers and the suppliers, because we owed the car companies a debt because I believe they saved the world. Our forces.
That's an up note that we can end the show on.